river he'd frozen had been a lot bigger. Astri addressed Dario and Damon. "Did either of you think to bring something to eat on this expedition?" Dario and Damon both shook their heads. "I can understand you not thinking ahead, Your Majesty," said Astri. "But this old fool should know better. It takes a lot of fuel to work wizardry on such a scale."
"There's some dried meat and hardtack in my pack," whispered Einan weakly. "I put it there at the start of my wander year, and never had a chance to eat it."
"Thank goodness for that," said Astri. "No time like the present." Astri rummaged in his pack, taking care to avoid sharp shards of fractured flying disc, and found the meat and biscuits. She watched Einan eat both as the eastern horizon revealed hints of a rising sun.
"I have to tell you about my surprise," said Einan after a few bites.
Damon had been alternating between staring at the frozen river and staring at Einan. Sometimes he shook his head. Once he whistled. "Just a moment, lad," he said. He threw up a privacy sphere around the four of them with a word and a gesture. "Now we can talk," he said. Einan told them about his plan. Astri clapped her hands and grinned. Dario pumped his fist and laughed, glad the noise wouldn't carry outside the privacy sphere.
"Brilliant," said Damon. "I'm impressed. You got Thatcher and Dotham to help you?"
"I did," said Einan.
Astri put her hands back on his head. He was starting to feel better, but kept eating.
"Nud gave me the idea."
"Did he now?" said Damon. "Good for Nud."
He paced a few times and looked back across the ice-covered Brenhaven.
"I should tell our Roma allies about your surprise."
"I'll alert the Biffalanders after I'm sure Einan's well," said Astri. "We don't want their dragon ships running aground on the ice."
"I'm coming with you," said Dario. "I want to see the looks on King Bajani and Queen Signy's faces when you tell them. You can fly me back to the Royal Army when we're done."
"You're going directly back to camp, Your Majesty," said Astri.
"Very well," said Dario. "That's the wiser course, blast it."
Einan finished his food and began to stand. Dario helped him to his feet and shook Einan's hand, then collected flying discs to distribute to Damon and Astri. Without external support, Einan wobbled on his feet. Astri reached out to help. She put one arm around Einan to steady him. Then one of her fingers touched Einan's red mage stone. Something crackled. Einan felt her channel a tiny fraction of the mage stone's power into his body, replenishing some of the energy he'd lost freezing the river. Everything was different. Brighter. Stronger, somehow. Einan had yawned earlier, but now he didn't feel tired at all. He felt like he could wrestle a mountain lion and win 2 matches out of 3. Einan straightened up, standing without need of assistance. He smiled a broad smile at Astri, then gave her a hug.
"Will you be all right here, young man?" asked Astri when they'd disengaged. "We should all be going."
"Don't worry about me," said Einan. "I'm fine, thanks to you. I'll head back west to make sure my surprise comes off as planned in a few minutes. We've got time before both armies take the field."
"Perhaps an hour," said Dario, noting the position of the sun. "Not more than that."
"Safe travels," said Einan.
He yawned, then smiled.
"And you," said Astri from her flying disc.
Dario, standing behind her, nodded.
"I have another job for you," said Damon, as he mounted his own disc. "The details can wait, though. We can discuss it after the battle."
"Yes, sir," said Einan. Yes, Damon."
Einan was still worried about his red maidstone. Even with the small transfer, the energy inside it was like a captive thing that wanted to escape. He was afraid what might happen if he didn't release it soon, or if it broke free on its own in the wrong place. He didn't want it to be a threat to his friends or the kingdom. His finger began to buzz. It was the ring he'd originally received from Dothan. He tugged on its band until it expanded. A battle was already in progress on the other side of the interface.
"Einan," said Dothan, as lightning blasts and fireballs filled the air behind him. "If you're here, come south, a mile or so below the royal encampment. We need your help. I've got to go."
The connection abruptly terminated, and the wide band shrank back down to ring-sized. Einan returned the ring to his finger.
"On my way," he said to empty air. As he rose, he spotted 12 small dragons high above him, their scales glinting red and orange, as well as gold in the dawn light. Einan waved to Sigrun and Ranvegir and their friends, and sped south.
Chapter 66. Tuathal and Gwynedd. King Tuathal allowed Ursa to lift him to the top of the royal observation platform on her flying disc. He didn't have the time or inclination to climb the 4 flights of stairs that would take him there. The upper level had a waist-high railing to prevent anyone from falling and provided a vantage point high enough for Tuathal and Duke Nealon, his senior-most commander, to observe the course of the battle.
"Stay close in case I need you," said the king.
"Yes, sire,"
said Ursa softly. She put her flying disc on her shoulder and moved as far away from Tuathal as she could manage on the 20-by-20-foot floor of the platform.
"What about me?"
shouted Princess Gwynedd from the ground below. "You don't expect me to climb up there in a skirt, do you?" The soldiers standing guard on either side of her were laughing. Tuathal and Nealon, a compact man with huge scarred forearms covered in tattoos, exchanged smiles. Nealon was an experienced military commander. He'd been a young bravo from the streets of Ryas before he'd joined the royal guard. He'd fought beside Tuathal and his father at the gates of Nova Eboracum. Tuathal respected him, considering the man almost as crafty a strategist as he was. The king had made the rough-hewn soldier a duke after eliminating one of his nobles who'd been showing a stubborn tendency to follow his own counsel instead of doing what Tuathal told him.
"Might as well lift her up," said Nealon, "if only to keep her quiet."
Tuathal motioned to Ursa, who reluctantly approached.
"Fetch the princess," he said, "but try not to give her a smooth ride."
"Yes, your majesty," Ursa replied.
She placed her flying disc on the platform and stepped onto it, lifting off then descending to do as she'd been ordered. Soon, Gwynedd's complaints stopped, only to be replaced by grumbles from her guards, who now realized that they would have to climb 4 flights wearing mail. After a short debate, the guards decided the princess could be guarded just as easily from the base of the high platform as its top. Gwynedd dismissed Ursa with a wave when she landed near Tuathal and stepped off the wizard's flying disc.
"You're so kind to your captives," said the princess.
"Stay quiet and observe my victory," said the king.
"Our victory," said Gwynedd.
Duke Nealon was wise enough not to say he agreed with the princess's way of putting things. He was privy to almost as much information about the king's plans as Vero, and knew he was due to receive a much larger ducal estate in Darren after Tamloch won. Tuathal stepped to the forward edge of the platform. It was 40 feet tall and built on top of a modest hill that made its total elevation nearly 100 feet above the level of the river. He could see his own troops arrayed before him, like green blocks on his sand table. Heavy cavalry, heavy infantry, archers and peasant levies were in their predetermined positions. Reserves were in the rear, but ready to deploy to either flank as necessary. Individual scout wizards circled above the army, keeping watch from high above, while tight groups of wizards closer to the ground tossed small fireballs or tiny spheres of lightning from hand to hand, like beginning jugglers. Beyond the warriors of the Royal Army of Tamloch was a wide patch of unoccupied ground, the site of the battle to come. In the distance, past the open field, were the ranked units of blue-clad soldiers in Darren's army. Tuathal was pleased to see that his army was larger, though not by much, as he'd hoped. Darren must have been able to assemble more of its levies from the southern reaches and west to the borderlands than his spies had reported.
"Speaking of reports," thought Tuathal, "where's that report Vero owes me on the status of the Bifalanders?"
He rubbed his chin.
"It's probably nothing. That fireball just before dawn was disconcerting, however. The scout wizards had insisted it was a young wizard heading east, probably trying to get away before the armies engaged."
Tuathal leaned against the railing. Heights didn't bother him. He knew the Darren encampment wasn't far behind Darren's army, and behind the encampment was the wide gate linked to Vero's surprise. Gwynedd interrupted his contemplation of the field and joined Tuathal at the rail. She didn't speak at first, which pleased Tuathal. He wanted another moment to savour his preparations.
"Why are you being so mean to me?" she asked.
"Why is it always about you, princess?" Tuathal wondered. "Don't you know it's always about me?"
He laughed,
The two of them were well matched. "My apologies, my dear," said the king. His tone held only a hint of patronizing mockery. He didn't think Gwinnett would notice. "I've been preoccupied." He waved his hand at the scene below. "And you are technically my captive, not yet my queen. We have to keep up appearances." Gwinnett snorted. Tuathal was surprised. He'd never heard her make that sound before and didn't like it. Gwinnett changed her tack. "I want to be married in Brendinas," she said, surprising Tuathal. "On Midsummer Day in the palace gardens, or the grand hall if it rains. I'll wear a beautiful green and blue gown, and Dario will walk me down the aisle."
"Excuse me," said the king. "I never thought you were the type to focus on frivolities."
He faced Gwinnett and saw she was smiling. He wondered what subtext of hers he was missing.
"Of course not," said Gwinnett. "But while you've been concerned with battles, alliances and armies, someone has to think about how to get the people of Darren to love you as much as I do."
"More than that, I hope," said Tuathal.
He relaxed, glad he hadn't been completely wrong about Gwinnett. He'd need her for the next few years, at least. Then perhaps a convenient accident.
"We'll restage the ceremony in Rias, so your nobles and subjects will see you can be changed through the love of a good woman," said the princess.
"Perhaps my subjects," said Tuathal. "My nobles will know better."
"Whatever," said Gwinnett. "We can save the details for later."
"There is the small matter of winning the battle first," said the king.
He left Gwinnett at the rail and returned to Duke Neelan at the middle of the platform.
"Where's your wizard?" he asked. "I want an update on the Bifferland fleet." "I sent Terry down to the keepers of the Blue Whale," said Duke Neelan. "I thought you might want to share a bottle of wine before we watch the defeat of Darren's army."
"I might," said Tuathal, "but I expect it will be too early for wine when we win. The battle should be over before noon."
"I expect a swift victory as well," said Neelan, "but we'll be glad to have a glass of red from the Isle of Vines, no matter what the hour."
Tuathal nodded, acknowledging his most senior commander's plan, if not sharing it. The king stretched his shoulders and admired the construction of the viewing platform. It was built from logs and rope and had been erected before sundown the previous day. Vero had suggested a physical platform, since it would free up 6 or 8 wizards who would otherwise have to lift an extra-large observation disc with their magic. The king expected his brother was using those additional wizards to implement his surprise. Gwinnett called to Tuathal.
"Is that one of your projects?"
"What?" asked the king.
"All that ice on the river,"
Gwinnett answered. Tuathal and Duke Neelan rushed to her side and followed her pointing arm. The Brenavon was frozen from shore to shore.
"Blast!" said the king. "Now we'll have to worry about the Roma," said the duke.
"It must be Elderman returned," said Gwinnett. "This is just like the Master Mage freezing the Abernoth when you and Dari fought at the gates of Nova Eberacum. I thought he was dead."
"Blast!" Tuathal repeated, tugging off one of his rings. "I have to talk to Vero. Why didn't he warn me something like this might happen?"
Chapter 67. Melin Carreg.
It was still dark beside the wide gate in the valley. The only illumination came from glowing balls above the head of Merry, Nud, and the 4 wizards sent by Intira to protect the gate's integrity. Nud's sphere of light had been created by Einan and was still tracking his movements, floating a yard up from his forehead. Rocky was resting on a patch of dried grass with Chi on the padded saddle strapped to the wyvern's broad back. The Raconette was weaving long strands of straw-coloured grass into a circle. Chi hopped down from Rocky's back to Nud's nearby shoulders and gently placed the woven circle on Nud's head. The big man rubbed the fur on Chi's back, and a higher-pitched sound of contentment came from the Raconette to join Rocky's deep basso hum. Nud didn't seem to notice Chi's gift. Merry wondered if all Raconettes wove grass, maybe as part of lining their nests. She wasn't sure, though. Chi seemed brighter than any animal she'd encountered who wasn't a wizard's familiar. Roush, Dothan's large hound, was able to communicate with him in complex ways she couldn't follow. Tuto, Furch's owl familiar, had a particularly prickly disposition and obeyed Furch's instructions up to a point. Three examples weren't enough to generalize, but she wouldn't be surprised if Chi found a piece of chalk and started drawing geometric figures from Euclid's Elements on a piece of slate. Was Rocky really Einan's familiar too? Mary wondered. It wasn't fair that Einan had two familiars when she didn't have any. Mary watched Rocky for a few moments. The wyvern's long body was only partially lit by the glowing ball above Nud, who was leaning into Rocky's shoulder, inside the protective curve of the wyvern's long neck. Rocky is as comfortable with Nud as he is with Einan, Mary realized. Could non-wizards have familiars too? That really wouldn't be fair. It felt odd for it to be close to dawn in Darren, while still in the middle of the night in Melyn Carrick. Mary was tired, and the lows and grunts of the herds farther up the valley were soothing. She'd had to rub her eyes more than once while waiting for word from the other side of the gate. She wanted to step through to the Darren side herself to look for Einan, but knew her role was here. Someone had to get things started. Nud looked relaxed on the outside, but inside his mind was in turmoil. He'd known Fircha was his mother and Princess Seren was his grandmother all his life. He was well aware that he was first in line to be king of Darren, but was quite happy to have Dario fill that role as next in line. The biggest shock of the day was learning the identity of his father and finding out he was second in the Tamlock succession. King Dario, the swordsman who'd tricked Scavender on the Biffalander flagship the previous afternoon, was the rightful heir to the throne of Tamlock. And my cousin, Nud realized, once he'd given it thought. Our fathers are brothers. Was there a chance Fircha had lied to him? Nud wondered. Would Queen Caris consent to a test of their relationship made by a neutral wizard, not Fircha or Dothan or Daemon? I could find a hedge wizard at random in Brendinas to see if Fircha's assertions were true, if I had a hair from the old queen's head and maybe one from Dario. He scratched his head and felt the circlet of golden grass Chi had placed there. Then Nud remembered the embroidered pillowcases Daemon had said were a gift from his great-grandmother. Gold crowns and royal Darren blue dragons. It seemed more and more likely that the old queen not only knew of Nud's existence, but of his status as the old king's true heir. Fircha wasn't lying, unless Daemon was. The old wizard could have commissioned embroidered pillowcases from anyone and told Nud a story to play games with Nud's head. Nud felt like a pawn in a particularly vicious and complicated game of Sharmat. With a master mage for a grandfather and a father, as well as Fircha for a mother, he was glad learning wizardry had never appealed to him. How could I ever live up to their expectations? Nud considered. The only good thing about being a wizard would be that they couldn't force him into being king. Kings never have time to themselves. They can't tramp around the countryside on their own, repairing fences or finding wild tubers for dinner. They're surrounded by palace intrigue and have to worry about invasions, the loyalty of their barons and raising money for the treasury. They can never know if potential mates love them or love their crowns. Worst of all, thought Nud, kings don't have time to read. At least, I don't expect they do. Maybe Dario can tell me. Nud unconsciously brought a hand up to stroke his chin. He couldn't see Chi, now back on Rocky's back, imitating his motion with comic precision. Mary noticed, but didn't smile. She recognized Nud's expression and could tell he was deep in thought. She got the same way from time to time, usually on her solo trips down the Ruthrow. The larger part of her brain would be thinking, while a smaller part watched for rocks and steered around them. She hoped Nud could steer around his own rocks as easily. Why couldn't real life be like the stories in the Academy's library? Nud wondered. Kings in stories could make a difference for yeomen and tradesmen, lowering taxes and weeding out bad barons. They'd marry dairy farmers' daughters with freckles who didn't know they were kings and lived happily ever after. Unfortunately, Nud had read the history books, not just the made-up stories on the library shelves. He appreciated how hard it must be to be a king at all, let alone a good king, like old King Daroth the 24th. Nud's reverie was interrupted when Chi used his shoulder as an intermediate point on his way to the ground. The Raconette scampered past Mary and the four other wizards who'd been talking quietly amongst themselves.
Chi!
Said the Raconette, standing by the near corner of the wide gate. Mary and Nud moved to join Chi as he pointed at the disk of the sun on the other side. It had been light for close to an hour back in Darren,
but they were waiting for word that the Tamlock army had assembled. A woman in the eclectic robes of one of Darren's free wizards stepped across to the Melancarig side of the gate. Nud, Merry, and the other four wizards gathered around her. Chi hopped to Nud's shoulder for a better view. Rocky rose and came forward to join them, his massive black head looking down on the new arrival. The free wizard's eyes went wide when she saw Rocky, but then she noticed none of the others seemed worried, so she shared her message.
"Tamlock's forces are in place," said the free wizard. "At least most of them are. It shouldn't be more than 10 minutes before they sound their attack."
"Thank you," said Merry.
"What's all this about?" asked the free wizard. "Inthira didn't tell us."
"It's a surprise," said Nud. "A big surprise for Tamlock."
The free wizard looked puzzled.
"Did Inthira tell you and the others on your side to stay on your flying discs and protect the sides of the gate with shields?" asked Merry.
"She did," confirmed the free wizard. "But what is the surprise?"
"You'll soon see for yourself," said Merry. "Just be sure to fly at least 20 feet up."
The free wizard walked back through the gate, pulling her flying disc off her back as she went. Merry thought she heard her mutter something uncomplimentary about letting children be wizards. She wished she could be on the other side of the gate to see the woman's expression in a few minutes.
"Ready?"
Merry asked the other four wizards. They nodded, stepped onto their flying discs, and ascended. They'd protect the integrity of this side of the gate.
"Come on," said Nud.
He was already on Rocky's back with Chi on the wyvern's neck in front of him.
"I want to watch you make bolts of lightning."
"You and Rocky will add your own contribution," said Merry.
Rocky lifted his head and bellowed. Chi waved both his front hand paws above his head and said, "Chi!" The four of them flew to the far end of the valley, where the largest of Melancarig's 7 herds of wizards was grazing. Over 100,000 of the great beasts were peacefully sleeping or chewing cud, but not for long. It was time to start a stampede. Chapter 68 Einan. It was bright enough to see now, and the fog was lifting, at least as Einan flew south. He wasn't sure where to find Fircher and Dothan, but expected his magically augmented ears would hear them before he saw them. Finding the Darren army's encampment was easy. Most of the soldiers in blue were already on the mustering field, immediately north of the small city of tents opposite Tamlock's gathering forces. Einan had been wrong. He saw the battle to the south before he heard it. Green and blue fireballs lit up the ground, splashing off wizards' shields. Lightning blasts tracked jagged arcs, then thunder boomed, hurting Einan's ears. He cancelled his listening spell. 2 blue wizards, one with auburn hair that looked like a dandelion in seed, were trying to hold off 6 wizards in green. Imitating a hunting griffin, Einan hurtled down into the battle near Dothan and Fircher. He shouted for them to close their eyes, then released a tiny fraction of the energy stored in his red mage stone as light. A bright red ball appeared in the middle of the opposing wizards, 1,000 times brighter than stepping out into noon sunlight from a dark cave. The 10 green wizards paused their attack to recover, giving Einan a moment to talk to Dothan and Fircher.
"Is that Veru's surprise?" asked Einan,
pointing to a wide gate between 2 trees ahead of them.
"Is he going to send a herd of his own wizards through to attack us?"
"No," said Dothan, "but just as bad, if not worse. Thousands of southern clanlanders are on the other side of that gate, about to come through."
"We have to destroy the gate from this side," said Fircher. "It's the only way to stop them."
Einan nodded. He looked at the gate closely. Only 6 of the 10 wizards nearby had been attacking. The other 4 were holding shields over the top, bottom, and sides of the gate, protecting the circuit of powdered mage stone from damage. The center of the gate itself was unguarded. He pointed to his pulsing red mage stone.
"I'm going through," said Einan. "Maybe I can stop them before they cross over."
"Don't destroy their side of the gate before you return," said Dothan. "We need you here."
The 6 wizards in green were recovering from almost being blinded.
"Time to go," said Einan. He sped off toward the gate.
"Wait," shouted Fircher. "Veru!"
Einan didn't hear the rest of Fircher's warning. He transitioned through the interface, flying near the top of the rectangle. Once across, he initially saw tens of thousands of barbaric clanlanders wearing tartan blankets wrapped around their waists and not much else. Most carried spears and swords of varying lengths. Many held wicker shields. The braying sound of 100 sets of bagpipes filled the valley where the clanlanders were gathered, sounding like packs of wolves being tortured under a full moon. Einan thought the barbarians looked like the opposite of the pictures of the Roma legions he'd seen in Robin Goodfellow's peregrinations. The legionnaires looked exactly alike in standardized armor, shields, and weapons, while no two of the clanlanders looked alike. Most of the warriors below Einan were covered in fiercely swirling blue tattoos. Einan was glad his cousins, who'd fought off southern clanlanders, hadn't shared their experiences with him when he was small. He would have had nightmares for months. Near this side of the gate, Einan spotted four figures in more familiar Darren-style leather armor. It was Fox, Oaf, Dolt, and Fool, the men from Masterlands he'd encountered going down the Ruthra with Merry. They were standing on a small hill to the left of the gate. A crossbow bolt from Fool buzzed past Einan's ear like an angry wolf hornet. Einan triggered his shields. "I'm an idiot," he thought. "I should have put my shields up before I went through the gate." Below, he saw Fool cocking his crossbow and loading another bolt. Einan ascended and moved away from the gate. Presiding over the far end of the valley was a tall mountain that reminded Einan of a great seated bear, with its arms the hills that defined the valley's wide floor. The mountain was rocky and covered with talus, the slippery fragments of rock Einan had found a challenge to cross when he'd first left home to start his wander year. The top third of the mountain was still blanketed with snow. This mountain wasn't anything like the massive purple peaks around Melyn Carrig, but by the standards of a young man from the Coombe, it was big enough. More crossbow bolts and an orange fireball hit Einan's shield as he reconnoitred. He flew higher as the bagpipes' cries grew louder. The clanlanders were ready to go through the gate. Einan's red magestone pulsed hot and fast, strobing crimson light across the snow near the top of the mountain. Lightning struck his shield and sent small, tingling jolts of electricity inside it, making the hairs on his arms stand up. The clanland wizard's attacks made Einan's red magestone even more eager to release its energy. He didn't turn around to see how many pursued him until he made it to a spot 100 feet above the mountain's white summit. 5 clanland wizards were closing on his position. Each had a strong protective shield. Einan bled off a tiny portion of the energy from his red magestone to make his own spherical shield, as thick and strong as possible. He sent an anchoring spear of solidified sound from the base of his shield and sank it 20 feet into the stone of the peak. Then he leaned back and gave his red magestone permission to release the energy it had stored when it helped him freeze the river. At the last second, Einan called on his blue magestone to moderate the blast, so the top of the mountain was only struck a hammer blow, not disintegrated. He was lucky his blue magestone could act fast enough. Einan bounced around the interior of his shield like he was rolling down a steep hill inside a barrel. The blast above his head had driven the spike so deep into the rock at the peak that the bottom third of his shield was embedded there. Einan shook his head to clear it and looked up. A sphere of crimson energy was only now contracting. It still illuminated the land like the light of a dozen suns. Down into the valley, Einan saw the true damage he'd done. His fireball had melted the snow on the mountain all at once. It cascaded down, turning the Talus slope into a wave of churning fragments of stone that washed over the southern clanland barbarians like a flood made of knives. The lucky ones nearest the gate ran through it ahead of the slurry of Talus, but most of the clanlanders had been knocked off their feet by the blast and caught in the deadly wave coming down the mountain. Einan swooped down the mountain behind the melted snow and Talus and examined the gate. It was still functioning. Demoralized clanlanders were still crossing over, wet and covered with cuts and bruises from sharp rocks. The Masterlanders stood defiantly atop their small hill. The initial blast had clearly knocked them over, but now they were back on their feet. Oaf and Dolt screamed at Einan as he flew over their heads. Einan stopped for a moment. "Why are you fighting with barbarians?" he asked. "You're men of Darren." "Are you really that stupid?" asked Fool. "What do you mean?" asked Einan. He didn't like being called stupid, especially by Fool. "You and Derry's daughter are the reasons we're with the clans now," said Fox. "Derry's daughter wouldn't go along with our fun and said she'd tell the Earl." "We didn't wait around to be banished," said Fool. "Seems like you made your own trouble," said Einan.
"And you made plenty of trouble for yourself," said Fox. "Enough clanlanders made it through to attack Darren's royal army from the rear."
"I'll have to do something about that," said Einan.
He crossed the barrier at 20 feet above the ground and saw the result of the floodwaters that had shifted through the gate to Darren. The four green wizards closest to the gate had been caught in the deluge and washed away. Dothan and Furcher used planes of solidified sound to push the remaining 6 surprised Tamlock wizards through the wide gate's interface before they recovered from the shock. Furcher stared at Einan and raised an eyebrow. Dothan nodded at Einan, and the young wizard used a fraction of the remaining power in his red magestone to burn up the sparkling rope covered with magestone fragments that formed the upper side of the gate. Tiny bits of magestones fell like glittering rain.
"Well done," said Dothan, as he circled Einan on his flying disc. "I don't know what you did exactly, but it's hard to argue with your results."
"It might have been better if you'd stopped all the Clanlanders, not just most of them," noted Furcher. They saw perhaps 2,000 warriors wearing tartans, digging themselves out of piles of talus and searching for shields and weapons. The Clanlanders didn't look happy. They eyed the Darren army's encampment not far to the north. 2 blonde girls with long braids circled Einan, Dothan and Furcher on small gold dragons.
"Hello, Einan," said Sigrun.
"This is awesome," said Ranveigir,
staring down at the aftermath of the flood.
"Are those Southern Clanlanders? I've never seen any of them before."
"Yes, they're Southern Clanlanders," said Einan. "There are 8,000 or 10,000 of them on the other side of the gate I just closed."
"Wow," said Ranveigir.
She moved her head and her braid swung back and forth, emphasizing her excitement.
"Could you take a message back to your parents?" asked Einan. "I'll see where this is going," said Ranveigir.
"I'd be glad to," said Sigrun. "Biffalanders haven't tested the warriors against Southern Clanlanders yet either. They look like they'll be more fun to fight than legionnaires."
"See if Bajani can land troops north of here soon enough to prevent the Clanlanders from sacking our encampment," said Furcher.
"We'd really appreciate it," said Dothan.
"We'll hurry," said Ranveigir. "Please warn your mother and father about the ice across the river to the north," said Einan.
"We know about that," said Sigrun. "We watched you do it."
"You were awesome," said Ranveigir.
Einan smiled.
"Thank you," he said, giving a small bow to both girls. "You might also tell him to send enough ships up to the ice to form a broadside wall along it," Einan suggested.
"Why should they do that?" asked Ranveigir.
"Odds are good. You'll be able to collect a lot of Tamlock soldiers to ransom back to King Tuathal," said Einan.
"That's not fun," said Ranveigir. "I'll pass the word," said Sigrun.
She turned her dragon to the east, ready to leave.
"Thank you," said Einan. "You should find plenty of meat on the hoof to roast for tonight's dinner, too."
"Wow," said Ranveigir. "We're going to have a feast."
"Come along, cousin," said Sigrun.
The 2 girls leaned forward on their gold-scaled mounts and soon were just dots against the eastern horizon.
"If you hurry, you can get back to Tamlock's army in time to see your surprise pay off," said Furcher.
"Aren't you coming?" asked Einan.
"No," said Dothan. He glanced over at Furcher. She seemed deep in thought. "We still have to worry about Vero." Chapter 69. On Tuathal's Platform. A bald scout wizard with a fringe of grey hair landed on the observation platform near the king, Duke Neelan, and Princess Gwynedd. Irsa, the dark-haired and earnest young wizard Vero had assigned to King Tuathal, stood unobtrusively in a back corner.
"Report," barked Tuathal. "What did you learn?"
Irsa felt a flash of resentment inside at the king's tone. Vero's voice was honey, Tuathal's sour wine. She'd heard the king speak to her that way often enough and felt sorry for the bald scout wizard. She thought his name was Calvi.
"The ice is more than 2 feet thick, sire, your grace," said the scout wizard. "It's clearly a product of wizardry and looks strong enough to support an army should the Roma choose to cross the river."
"They're not crossing already?" asked the Duke.
No, your grace, said Calvi. "They've locked their shields into a wall on the far bank, but they're not advancing."
"What are they up to?" Tuathal asked Neelan. "My guess would be hedging their bets," said the Duke. "Perhaps they're double-crossing Darren and intend to wait and see who's winning before choosing sides."
Irsa shook her head, confident none of the others except Calvi could see her. Twisted minds always looked for devious answers.
"Send wizards to break up the ice with fireballs," said the king to Terry,
the wizard Vero had assigned to Duke Neelan.
"I don't care what Quintilius has in mind. I don't want him on this side of the river."
We don't have wizards to spare for that, Zaya, said Terry. They're all to the south.
Just do it, Tuathel commanded.
Yes, your majesty, said Terry.
The wizard jumped over the railing in a rush to get away from the king. Essa was pleased Terry was holding his flyer disc when he leapt.
Who froze the river? The king asked the scout wizard. Has Elderman returned from the dead?
Other flying scout wizards saw an old man fitting Elderman's description landing near the river, said Calvi. Of course, I fit that description as well. There's no guarantee it was Elderman.
What about the young one who threw that fireball? Asked the Duke.
It could be him as well, said the bald wizard, but it's unlikely.
Why so? Asked Princess Gwynedd. Don't underestimate the young. Look at Dario.
Tuathal didn't comment. He was thinking about soon being able to educate his son and turn him into a worthy heir, the sort of monarch who would never be underestimated.
The Elderman was in his 40s when he froze the Abernoth princess, said Calvi. It's hard to believe a young wizard would have the knowledge needed to perform such a feat.
Unless the Elderman taught him, thought Ursa. Tuathal considers himself astute, but Vero is the wiser brother.
Terry floated back up to the platform and nodded to King Tuathal to indicate his orders were being followed. A pair of less than powerful wizards who enjoyed Vero's liberal hand with beer and hard cider had been dispatched to try their hand at melting ice. Vero had thought them only fit to run messages and didn't have faith in them doing even that well.
Your Majesty, he said.
The king glared at Terry. He didn't like being interrupted during interrogations.
Wizards have been sent, Zaya, said Terry.
He tried, but failed to disguise a tremor in his voice.
Huh,
said Tuathal. He returned to his previous train of thought, answering Calvi.
I can think of another wizard in Darren who could do it. Who might that be? Asked Duke Neelan.
Thatcher,
said Princess Gwynedd, making it sound like a curse.
Correct, said the king. But it doesn't matter now who did it. The legions aren't crossing the river.
For now, said Ursa silently.
And everything is ready for us to crush Darren on the field.
Tuathal turned to Duke Neelan.
Give the order to advance. With pleasure, your majesty, said the duke.
He nodded to Terry, who triggered prearranged signals, notifying the other commanders that it was time. Pipes began to wail. Except in the cavalry units, the horses didn't like them. Drums echoed across the mustering field, calling all units to make ready. Tuathal watched with pride as the lances of his heavy armoured cavalry snapped up, the green pennants near their tips waving in the early morning breeze. Beside the king, Princess Gwynedd heard the drumming grow louder. It came from the west and sounded more like thunder than sticks hitting stretched skins. She looked in that direction, expecting storm clouds, but the sky was clear. The fog had vanished. It was one of those crystal spring days that make you glad to be alive, she thought. Gwynedd was still puzzled by the thunder and its increasing volume. Unbidden, Ursa stepped on her flying disc and rose up to scan the western horizon. If her king wasn't fast enough to command her, she could take the initiative to report on the phenomenon herself. All she could see to the west was a dark black line and a slowly rising cloud of dust.
Could it be a tornado? No, the dust would be higher. A spinning funnel not close to the ground.
Ursa crafted lenses to help her see better at a distance. It took her a few seconds to focus. When she did, all she saw were churning legs and thick-furred brown bodies splotched with curly black hair and horns. Large, sharp horns. Ursa descended slowly. The king was staring west along with Terry, the duke, and the princess. The king noticed her out of the corner of his eye and summoned Ursa to the front of the platform near the others.
Report, barked Tuathal. What did you see?
Ursa was uncertain. She wasn't sure what she had seen. The only animal remotely like these was one she'd seen in Tamlok's royal zoo on the palace grounds in Ryas. It was old and mangy, its fur falling out in places, and one of its horns had been sawed off, probably as a trophy, she supposed. She did remember the name of the beast on the side of its enclosure, though.
"Spit it out, you foolish child," the king insisted. "Don't keep me waiting."
Ursa's stomach knotted, and her throat grew tight, but she managed to squeeze out an answer.
"I'm not sure, Your Majesty, Your Highness, Your Grace," she said.
But I think it's wizens. Thousands and thousands of wizens.
Tuathal turned to Terry.
Get me Vero. I don't care what you have to do, but tell him to come here immediately. Tell him it's an emergency.
Yes, Your Majesty,
said Terry. Standing behind the king, he looked like a frightened rabbit.
Where's my head? Said Tuathal.
He reached for a plain gold ring on his right hand and removed it. With a word, he commanded it to expand.
Come on, come on, said the king. Answer me.
Tuathal glanced up and noticed the others still standing nearby.
Get away, he ordered. I need to talk to my brother in private.
Everyone gave the king room. Ursa created a 10-minute privacy bubble around Tuathal and shifted her feet to look west again. The front edge of the stampeding herd was colliding with the right flank of the Tamlok army. Like a hand shoving unit markers across a sand table, the soldiers on the right flank pushed against the troops in the centre, and those in turn ran east, colliding with the left flank. Everywhere, soldiers were dropping their weapons and shields to move faster. The cavalry units made the best time. They tossed their lances to the ground and rode east toward the river with tens of thousands of wizens on their heels and hooves. Tamloch's knights might have stood to fight, but their steeds would not. They caught the wizard's panic and sped toward the rising sun. When they reached the frozen river, they couldn't stop. Horses slid and skidded on the ice, tossing their armored riders and sending them out toward the island in the middle of the river, like stones flung by children for their amusement. They were joined by more soldiers and more wizards as a majority of Tamloch's army moved out onto the ice. Ursa adjusted the lenses that let her see farther. She saw wizards smash into soldiers and go down. Some of the big beasts hit the ice and just slid, tossing fighters into the air as they passed. Those fighters landed on other fighters who bounced off wizards until the entire frozen river was a confused, writhing mass of humans, horses, and wizards. The luckiest soldiers had reached the island and climbed trees. A few wizards calmly grazed on new leaves in the undergrowth below them, no longer driven by the urge to stampede. Looking to the right, at the south edge of the ice, Ursa noticed that Bifalander dragon ships had anchored their lengths flush against the frozen surface. There's no escape into the water in that direction, she realized. She shook her head sadly. So many soldiers, so many dead and wounded, so many frightened and injured beasts. Someone grabbed Ursa's arm and slapped her face. It was Tuathal. His privacy sphere had ended, and he was screaming at her.
I have to see what's happening, said the king. Make me lenses.
Ursa rubbed her cheek and generated a pair of distance lenses for Tuathal. She resolved to talk to Vero about a new assignment as soon as possible and stepped away from the king. Tuathal was angry. No, he was furious. Vero hadn't answered him, so he'd collapsed the golden hoop back into a small ring and returned it to his finger. Where was his brother, blast it? The king's temper grew hotter as he watched what was happening on the ice. The Roma were opening gaps in their shield wall and allowing Tamloch soldiers through to safety if they removed their weapons and armour. Hundreds upon hundreds of troops were taking that option. What looked like golden hummingbirds? No, small gold dragons were plucking men and women out of the chaos on the frozen river and dropping them on the decks of Bifalan dragon ships. More fighters lost, thought Tuathal, along with the battle. At least the southern clanlanders will do the Daran army damage. Tuathal pushed down his anger and controlled his frustration. This was a setback. He could still win the war by surrendering and naming his son as his heir. Ursa ignored the king for a few minutes. He would be focused on watching what transpired on the ice for some time. Instead, the young dark-haired wizard turned her gaze back to the west. She could see the last of the wizened herd thundering this way. Odd motions of other wizards attracted her. She saw a wizard. A young one, almost a girl, on a flying disc, shooting lightning bolts above the herd. Force beams of tight light from her fingertips kept the beasts moving straight toward where the Tamloch army had been, instead of spreading out. A huge black wyvern flew near the young wizard. It was encouraging the wizards to rush forward by snapping at them. The wyvern's mouth was wide. Ursa assumed it was roaring. I'd run away from that if I were a wizard, she thought. Then she realized something was on the wyvern's back. She increased her magnification and saw a tall young man and a tiny animal resembling a raccoon were riding the wyvern. Could today get any stranger? Ursa wondered. She laughed to herself. She might not need to ask Vero for a reassignment in the morning. She and the king might both be locked in Daran prison cells. Ursa didn't notice four creatures with the heads of eagles and the bodies of lions flying behind the wizard and the wyvern. Princess Gwynnett was pulling on her shoulder, demanding far-seeing lenses of her own. Chapter 70 Fircher and Dothan.
"What is Vero up to?" asked Dothan.
"You know his mind as well or better than anyone."
"I know his body better than anyone," said Fircher.
Dothan rolled his eyes at hearing more than he wanted to hear.
"Tuathal knows Vero's mind better than anyone," she continued. "I wish some of Vero would rub off on his brother."
"Not much chance of that after all these years, I expect," said Dothan.
"You're probably right," said Fircher.
The two of them were side by side on their flying discs, heading north toward the Daran army's encampment and Daran's army itself. They were flying slowly to give Fircher time to think.
"Would it help if I asked questions?" Dothan offered.
"Maybe," said Fircher. "I'll let you know if it doesn't."
"Very good," said Dothan.
"Let's go back to the differences between the way the two brothers think. Tuathal is as twisted as the Ruthro, winding its way through the marshlands, while Vero is fast and straight, like the river cutting through the gap at Ruthro Keep."
"Granted," said Fircher. "Tuathal's a snake, Vero an arrow."
"The attack by the southern clanlanders was straightforward," said Dothan. "So was the raid on the quarry near the Coombe. Nothing particularly devious about either one, except planning the quarry raid for dawn, and that's just good strategy."
"Right," said Fircher.
"That means we're looking for something else from Vero that's equally straightforward. It may be audacious, but it won't be devious."
"Keep going," said Fircher. "You're helping me think."
"Where is Daran most vulnerable?" asked Dothan. "What one thing could Vero do to hurt the kingdom the most?"
"He wouldn't," said Fircher.
"Wouldn't what?" asked Dothan.
"Kidnap Dario," said Fircher.
"Ha!" laughed Dothan. "How can he kidnap the king? Dario's in armor, in the middle of Daran's army, surrounded by soldiers and protected by wizards."
"Like Hiblig?" asked Fircher.
"We're in trouble," said Dothan.
"With luck, Einan will be with Dario by now," said Fircher. "That should help."
"How do you think Einan would fare against Vero?" asked Dothan. They'd already begun to accelerate the northward movement of their flying discs.
"If Einan manages to pull off some naive and creative piece of unexpected magic, he might stand a chance," said Fircher. "But I'd feel a lot better if I was there too."
"I'm not sure if you'd kill Vero or kiss him," said Dothan.
"Neither am I," said Fircher, smiling and shaking her head. "I'm going to summon Daemon," said Dothan.
"He can make a direct gate and jump from the Roma camp to Dario's side in seconds."
"I don't want to run to my father with all my problems," said Fircher.
Dothan stared at her.
"Summon him," she said. "This is too big to let my issues with Daemon get in the way of the good of the kingdom."
"I will," said Dothan. "Lock us together and keep me on course while I do." The two wizards sped north, a shared shield keeping them safe from attacks by Tamlok scout wizards.
"Uh-oh," said Fircher. "We're too late."
"No, we're not," said Dothan. "Daemon just said he'll be on his way."
"Look up," said Fircher.
Dothan did. Red streamers were ascending in the sky above the center of Daran's army.
"That's Einan," he said. "It has to be. Vero's already taken Dario."
"Maybe not," said Fircher. Dothan felt a buzzing from one of his rings.
"You go ahead," he said. "You can make better time without me. If you and Einan and Daemon can't handle Vero, nobody can."
"See you soon," said Fircher. Dothan reset his shield for self-guided flight, removed the buzzing ring, and made it grow. Chapter 71 With Daran's Army.
"What do you see, Inthira?" shouted Dario. "There's too much dust for me to make anything out."
Inthira descended to stand beside Duke Haydn and the king. Both men wore coats of plates over the gambesons, but hadn't donned their helms.
"Einan's surprise is working perfectly," Inthira said, as she shifted her flying disc to hang on her shoulders.
Three Tamlok soldiers and a confused wizard strayed close to the front ranks of the Daran army.
The soldiers were taken prisoner and placed under guard, while the wizened was directed at spearpoint toward a makeshift pen made from confiscated enemy shields reinforced by solidified sound. Wizards enjoyed roasted meat as much as warriors. A few minutes later, a strange-looking giant deer with wide, flat antlers trotted by. It stayed far enough away from the soldiers to avoid capture, but prompted speculation about its nature up and down the Daran lines as it passed in review. Some were curious about whether or not it would be good to eat, while others remarked that its sharp front hooves looked dangerous and could probably do a lot of damage to any pack of wolves or squad of fighters who tried to attack it. One archer wondered if the unusual animal could be ridden. Her mates joked that they'd like to see her try. In the end, the great beast turned back west and headed for the forested uplands located in that direction. Young soldiers asked grey-haired veterans if they'd seen anything like the unusual beast before, but none of them had. 11 wizards were arrayed around the king and duke in addition to Inthira. They had multiple roles, from observing the enemy and delivering messages to defending Dario, Duke Haydn, and the duke's senior officers. At present, there wasn't much need for the wizard's defensive role. By Princess Gwynnett's prior arrangement, Hiblig was one of the wizards attending the king. The belligerent and overbearing mage stared impatiently across the field toward where Tamlok's army had been before the wizards arrived, looking for someone or something he couldn't find. Hiblig nervously smoothed his blue-striped robes and shifted unhappily from foot to foot. Duke Haydn noticed Hiblig's odd movements. "There's a privy past the king's heavy cavalry and 20 yards to the rear," said the duke. "Don't be gone too long, and watch your step, especially near the horses."
"Thank you, Your Grace," said Hiblig.
He spared a moment to scan the northern horizon again, and lingered at some sort of thrown-together log platform, before moving off in the direction the duke had indicated. He forgot to look down until it was too late, and grimaced as he wiped the sole of his boot on a rock.
"No great loss," whispered Dario to Haydn, as his mother's favourite wizard walked away.
"Isn't it wonderful?" the duke said. "No losses at all, and no injuries except for the odd sprained ankle or broken arm soldiers get on every campaign."
"I meant it was no great loss to have Hiblig leave," said Dario. "The man's lip prints are all over my mother's..."
"Behind you, Your Majesty," said Inthira. "Turn around, please. You've got a visitor."
Dario turned and flashed a broad smile.
"Einan, welcome," said the king.
"This is no visitor, Inthira. This is Einan from the Coombe, the architect of our victory. He is an honoured guest. Hail, Einan!"
Several nearby soldiers who'd been listening to Dario sent up a ragged cheer of, "Hail, Einan!" But it faded fast, since they had no idea what someone named Einan had done to deserve praise. Einan's cheeks turned red. He wasn't used to compliments from royalty.
"No need for that, Your Majesty," said Einan after a deep breath. "I came to report, and to see the wizards rout Tamlok's army."
"I can understand that," said Dario. "Every genius likes to see his plans realized, but you're too late. Inthira says her scout wizards tell her Tamlok's army is demoralized and neutralized, skating around on the frozen Brynaven with enough wizards to feed the kingdom for half a year. I'll have to come up with a suitable reward for your service, Einan of the Coombe."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," said Einan.
He could feel blood rushing to his cheeks again, and blurted out something he knew he shouldn't say.
I live in the Coombe, sire, but that's not where I consider I'm from. I'm Einan of Haywall. You've probably never heard of it."
"Of course I have," said Dario. "From maps, anyway. A king must know the land he rules. Haywall is west of Werrel, in the central Coombe. You're part of the barony of Caerluin. How is old... what's his name?"
"The Baron?" asked Einan. "I've never met him."
"His loss," said Dario. Einan was confused and pleased. He never expected King Dario to have heard of Haywall, and was happy the wizened stampede had worked so well.
"Nud gave me the idea," said Einan. "He showed me the wizened herd back in Melin Carrig, and said we needed to come up with a few surprises of our own. I just put the pieces together."
"I'll have to come up with a suitable reward for Nud, too," said the king. "Where is he? And where's that wyvern of yours? And Merry, for that matter. I expected her to be standing hip to hip with you."
"There they are," said Einan, pointing over Dario's head.
The king, Duke Haydn, and most of the people nearby followed Einan's outstretched arm to see a black wyvern and a single wizard on a flying disc gliding toward the army. Archers near the king cocked their bows and knocked quarrels.
"Stand down,"
said Dario, adding a gesture with both hands, pushing toward the ground.
Intira, signal to them that it's safe to land. Einan laughed when he saw Intira's signal. The curly-haired wizard created a blue-tinted solidified sound construct in the shape of a giant hand and used it to beckon his friends down. He waved to Merry and she waved back. As Rocky and Nud got closer, Einan spotted his raconette familiar waving too.
"Geez, here too, Zaya," he told the king. "Fetch my arming cap, please," said Dario. "Better keep my helm nearby too."
A pair of royal attendants rushed off to fulfill their king's request. Einan could understand why Dario, with his shaved head, especially needed a padded arming cap under his helm. Then he made the connection to his announcement of Chi's impending arrival.
"Don't want your head polished today?" he asked the king.
"Precisely," said Dario. There was plenty of space in front of them for Rocky to land. Merry touched down gently behind the wyvern, put her flying disc on her back, and ran to meet Einan. He'd stepped out from the royal entourage to greet her, and they embraced.
"It worked beautifully," said Merry. "The whole herd ran straight down the valley toward the gate. Nud said that was their usual migration path to their other grazing grounds."
"Wonderful," said Einan.
"Me or your plan?" teased Merry.
"Both," said Einan.
Nud joined them, and Einan gave him a hug as well.
"Thanks for your help," he told his friend. "I hope Rocky followed instructions."
"He's a good wyvern," said Nud.
Rocky stretched out his head close enough for Nud to rub one side of his jaw, then nudged Einan.
"Who's a good boy?" said Einan, rubbing the other side.
The wyvern let out a satisfied rumble from his chest, then turned and took to the air again. He'd spotted another stray wizened and set off for an early feast of his own that didn't require hours of roasting. Chi had jumped from Rocky's back to Nud's shoulder moments earlier. Now he shifted to his usual spot on Einan's shoulder and eyed the king's shaved head as Einan, Nud and Merry walked across the trampled grass to join the king and the others around him. When Einan was close enough to Dario, Chi pushed off and landed on the king's shoulder. Before Chi could start polishing Dario's head, a nearby retainer handed the king a small cloth bag. Dario dangled it in front of Chi.
"Want some dried cherries, little fellow?" asked the king,
who knew it was a rhetorical question. Chi grabbed the bag, kissed the top of Dario's head, and jumped back to Einan. The raconet hid himself in the space on top of Einan's pack, partially enclosed by the upper section of his flying disc. From time to time, Einan could hear contented sounds of chi-chi-chi behind him. Einan had another chance to see Nud and Dario together, standing just a few feet apart. The resemblance between the two men was striking. Einan told himself he'd ask Nud about it later, in private. The old, made-up stories he'd heard and read were full of illegitimate royal children, and he didn't want to embarrass his friend by asking about it in public. Merry didn't seem concerned by how much the two men looked alike. She was talking to the king.
"Hi, Dario," said Merry. "You look good in armour."
Einan saw Duke Haydn hide a smile, then smiled himself when he watched a young woman with brown hair step out from behind the Duke to stand beside Dario. She was poised in a way the girls back in the coombe could never be, and wore a sky-blue leather jacket over a wine-coloured shirt and practical black pants tucked into high black boots. He was surprised to see someone who clearly wasn't a soldier or a wizard here with the king on the battlefield, but assumed it was as safe to be here as anywhere, given that Tamlok's army was skating on not-so-thin ice to the east.
"Who's this?" asked the young woman, indicating Merry. "Jennet, meet Merry. Merry, Jennet," said Dario. "She's with Einan."
Einan put his arm around Merry's shoulders and smiled at Jennet. Merry looked up at Einan with a different kind of smile, pleased he was more interested in her than Jennet.
"Any friend of Dario's is a friend of mine," said Merry. "I look forward to getting to know you," said Jennet.
The king put his arm around the newcomer.
"Jennet is my favourite Charmat partner," he said. Duke Haydn cleared his throat. "Since we're all friends here," said Dario, "didn't you say something about coming here to make a report, Einan?"
"Of course, I forgot," Einan replied. "I'm here to tell you we dealt with Vero's surprise, an attack from the rear by barbarians from the southern clanlands."
"Dealt with?" asked Duke Haydn. "The southern clans could raise a large force. Did Vero build a wide gate like Fletcher did for the legions?"
"Exactly," said Einan. "I had a lot of energy stored in my magestone from freezing the river."
He looked at Dario, who nodded, remembering how much Einan's unusual magestone had been pulsing. "So I went through the gate and released it all at once," Einan continued. "A couple of thousand clan landers got through, but some friends are taking care of them before they can reach our encampment." "Let me guess," said the king. "You offered Bajani and Signy